exercises that are laid out for us in AA. What happened was I got to a point where I did not have a sufficient defense against the drink. And knowing what booze would do to me, because it had done it so many times before, being very clear of mind what booze would do to me, and knowing that it probably was the craziest thing I could possibly do, I made a decision to buy a gallon of vodka and take it home and drink it. And anyone knowing anything about me would have considered that just about as insane as going to a gun store and buying a shotgun and bringing it home and blowing your leg off or something. I mean, it was just about that crazy, knowing what alcohol did to me. So when the relapse was over, which it lasted about 6 months or so, I struggled back into AA with like a renewed enthusiasm to basically try to get this thing. And slowly it dawned on me that Alcoholics Anonymous is not just a group of people that are sitting there encouraging you to not drink one day at a time like they are, but it's a place where you can learn some spiritual tools that will so transform your life that you will be a different person. You will be a recovered you will end up being a recovered alcoholic if you follow these suggestions and do the work that's required. And at the end of the step process is a very important part, and that's the 12th step. And the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. So what happens is once you get past the point of just showing up at AA and just listening and, you know, not really participating in any of the instructions in the book, once you start doing that, some things happen to you. And I know this through experience because I've taken a lot of people through the book. I've been through the book myself. So my own personal experience and my experience working with others convinces me without a doubt that a transformation process happens with someone who goes through this work. They get to the other side and they have a very, very valuable experience to share. That experience basically is that I've recovered from alcoholism through the practice of these steps. And now that particular individual can share their experience with someone else and hopefully guide someone else through the process to their recovery. Now, I want to be very, very clear on recovery and cure for anybody that's not clear on that. We're never cured of alcoholism. A cure is basically the removal of the illness. If you're cured of something, the illness has been removed. If you're recovered from something, the symptoms of the illness are removed. And today, I can honestly tell you that the symptoms of alcoholism have been removed in me for many, many years now. I'm not saying that I'm perfect and everything goes great and I don't lose my shit or anything like that. I do, but the fact of the matter is that it's not alcoholic. It's more along the lines of life issues, and it's a lot more in balance than my emotional nature was prior to going through the steps. So I found out early on that you have to give it away to keep it was one of the things that they would say. And whatever I got, I had to be willing to give it away. Now, of course, there are many, many different types of 12-step work. And until you are a recovered alcoholic, there's still a lot of 12-step work that you can do. You can make it possible for the alcoholic to get to the message. But once you've been through the steps, now you can actually carry the message to the alcoholic. And there's a very, very big difference between those two. I believe that a lot of the work that I've done with alcoholics has increased my quality of life and my spiritual condition an incredible amount. I don't know that I could have just gone through the steps and gotten it and then split, you know. I don't think that it works like that. I think that a spiritual life is something that you need to live, and you need to constantly and reinforce it with positive action and spiritual action. And one of those actions that I've found most beneficial, I believe, is helping another alcoholic. Now, specifically, what I'm going to talk about tonight is wet drunk work. Now, what that is that is the classic definition of the 12-step call. What happens is somehow you are referred to an alcoholic that is still drinking or just detoxing. And I would consider that wet drunk work. My first experience with wet drunk work happened when I was about, I was less than a year sober. And what happened was I got this call from this guy, and he said, it was late at night, and he said, "Chris, Satan is talking to me." I'm like, oh yeah?" And he's going, "Yeah, Satan is telling me to hurt people." And, you know, my first, I understand a little bit about Satan. I go, "How much coke are you using? Because, you know, how many grams of coke did you do tonight? Because coke and Satan, you know, work well together." And he goes, 4 grams, you know. And so I go, "Okay." I go, "You really want help?" And he said, "Yeah." So this is my first 12-step call. I know that you got to call somebody, because I'd been to enough 12-step meetings to realize that you have to call somebody. So I called up a buddy of mine. I said, "You know, this guy called me up. I need somebody to take him to rehab." And what we did was we got in the car and we drove over and we picked this guy up. And meanwhile, you have to understand, this guy was huge. He was a weightlifter, boxer type of guy, and he was whacked on coke, man. He was chirping like a squirrel. This guy was so high. And we put him in the back seat, and I pull out, and we're heading for Honesty House, actually. And I go, like, "How you doing?" And he goes, "Well, Satan is still talking to me." So I'm like, "Yeah?" And he goes, "Yeah, he's telling me to hurt people." I'm like, "Okay." And he goes, "Especially people that are trying to help me." You know, this guy's in the back seat. And I'm like, looking in the rearview mirror. It made for a nervous ride to the rehab. The poor guy was so whacked out that this particular rehab was not going to do much for him. They ended up shipping him off to Marlboro. And that was kind of a negative experience for me, because it was almost like one flew over the cuckoo's nest kind of thing. You know, when Jack Nicholson came back in with the scar on his head? I mean, it was almost like that. A different guy came out of the hospital, and they had him medded up like crazy. And it was kind of sad to see. But I want to state right now that a 12-step call, the ultimate desired goal of a 12-step call is to get somebody through the steps. And that's not going to happen during the initial visit. Sometimes, though, it says in this book that we favor hospitalization for the befogged. And I think I can define the 1935 term befogged to mean somebody that's chirping like a squirrel, you know, somebody that needs to be hospitalized for detox. I'll give you a statistic, and this is an accurate statistic. 15% of alcoholics get to a point where they suffer from delirium tremens when they quit drinking. That's like a violent form of detoxing, of withdrawal. 15% of that 15% that suffer from delirium tremens die from them. And what happens is you have a stroke or a heart attack or something. You know, most of the times your aorta blows up because your heart is pumping like a racehorse. It's going like this, and your aorta just pow, like a garden hose breaking. And that tends to void the old warranty right there. That's what happens to most people that die from detox. You don't want that to happen in your car, or like if you're detoxing the guy in the basement. Okay, it'll complicate the rest of the day. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that you can get the individual to the medical help that they need. If in doubt about the person's condition, call an ambulance. I mean, you know, you can go that far. My wife and I have alcohol in the house. Now, this is a judgment call. You know, if you're so new that having alcohol in the house is freaky for you, you probably haven't done enough step work to really be that good at doing a 12-step call anyway. So you need to look at that. But we keep wine and beer in the house. I'd say maybe once a year on a 12-step call, we'll throw it in the car with us, because we've seen that there are problems these days with places like St. Clair's detox. They've made us wait 6-8 hours to get somebody in. Here's a typical response at St. Clair's: "Hey, I got a hot one. I'd like to bring him in. Well, can you bring him in at 6 tonight? Why 6 tonight? It's 9 in the morning. Because that's when I get off shift." You know, oh, thanks a lot. I mean, it's not like they are anxiously awaiting the newest recruit. We're the type of people who we go into detox desperate, right? Maybe they put us on some Librium, maybe they don't. But we start to feel a little bit better the next day or 2 days later, and we start to realize that they're not really running the hospital in the best way. You know, there's some inadequacies as far as customer service here. And we start complaining and getting resentments. And then we storm out of the place against medical advice and not pay our bill. Okay, that's just typical alcoholic action. Why would they anxiously await our return once again, you know? So there are some problems at some of the local detoxes. Especially rehabs are really slow for you to get in, because they have to go through all the insurance stuff, you know? So I've found that lately, probably your best bet, if you have no other options, is to get somebody to the emergency room. You get them to the emergency room, and what the emergency room's policies usually are is to watch their vital signs, watch their blood pressure, and if necessary, get them on medication that will stabilize their condition so that they're not in a dangerous condition. If it's not necessary, like if your blood pressure isn't too bad, they'll let you suffer. They'll let you sit on the side of the bed just going out of your mind. But at least you'll be safe, and you're probably not going to die. Again, I'm emphasizing this because I don't want anybody that's overzealous in their 12-step work to do something wrong, and for a person to die on their watch, and that certainly does happen. I've had a lot of experience with people that are a little bit out of their mind. I'll give you my last experience. This guy had been drinking like round the clock. He's a beer drinker, and he had drank a case of beer by 10 o'clock in the morning. My wife and I knew that he was home struggling, and I just, for one reason or another, I just decided to call this guy up. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. He asked for help, and he said, "Help me out. I'm going to lose my job. My wife has left me. You know, I gained 700 pounds drinking Budweiser. I need some help." So we arranged for him to go into a rehab. Now, this guy has been in and out of rehab, and he's been in and out of working with us. He has worked with me. He's worked with my sponsor. He's worked with a bunch of guys. He's not the type of person who can come right into AA, get right into the steps, and get sober. He needed to be put away for a period of time. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. Anyway, we decided that he's been in so many different places, he needs to go away for a while. And we don't make that decision easily. You know, I especially don't make that decision easily. You have to have failed at absolutely everything else before I will suggest Elena Lodge. Okay? But we suggested Elena Lodge for this individual, and they have a detox that they use. Elena won't even take you until you've had tuberculosis tests. I mean, you know, everything. So you need to go to a medical facility to get cleared just to go into this rehab. So there's a place called Clearbrook out in Pennsylvania that they normally use. So we take this guy to Clearbrook. We're about three blocks from Clearbrook, and here's what he does.
He starts panicking. He starts having a panic attack. And he goes, you're not going to take me to somebody's house and put me down in somebody's basement, are you? Like this. And he starts freaking out that we're going to actually take him to somebody's house and put him in somebody's basement. And we're like, no, we're not going to put you in any basement. And we're calming him down, calming him down. Well, we finally get him signed into this place. And the guy I'm with, I'm saying, look, as soon as we get him in there, let's bug out of here. We don't want him to have a ride out of here. We don't want him to have a way out. You know, he's 50 miles into Pennsylvania. He's wigging out. Let's just let the place handle him. You know, the place should know how to handle him. So we leave. Well, he goes into his room, and he's got a roommate. And remember, he's like really on edge because he's detoxing. And the first thing the roommate says to the guy is, I hope you don't mind, but I don't sleep with any underwear. Okay, so he goes, what? And he just bolts out of the place and just heads for the hills. You know, he grabs his ditty bag and he takes off. And this is not what his family wants to hear. Okay, they're not real happy about him bolting and calling them from the Morristown train station saying, I'm back. You know, he just went through like 16 days worth of like convincing them to go away. So this bodes ill on the home front, and he ends up really losing his job. The woman leaves and doesn't want any kind. It's really, really bad, and he's home drinking himself to death. And this is when I decide to call him. You know, it's one of the things that you want to do with somebody is you want to get them when they're down. You want to get them at the lowest possible point. You want to get them when they've just come out of another blackout and they have a summons for a DWI in their pocket for the fourth time, or they've fouled up at work one more time. You know, you want to get them at their lowest point, because that's usually a point where they're more susceptible to a life based on spiritual action, you know, which is not something we're all lining up to do before things get bad. Anyway, I give this guy a call, and I'm just saying, you know, I'm saying, like, how's it going over there? How you feel after drinking like a case of beer? And for some reason or other, I say, here, talk to Mary Beth, and I put Mary Beth on, she can be magic at periods of time. And she said something to this guy, and he said, I want to go back. So I'm not driving him 2.5 hours back out to Pennsylvania again. So I happen to know an alcoholic limo driver. So I go, here's his number. You know, you're going to pay for this ride, but he's going to come get you, and he's going to take you. He's going to trundle you off to Clearbrook. And hopefully you get a different roommate. So anyway, that's what happens. And he's in long term now. And, you know, who knows? I'm not a huge, huge fan of treatment centers. I believe a treatment center is preliminary treatment for alcoholism. I believe that the treatment for alcoholism is meetings, steps, and service. But I believe that sometimes preliminary treatment can be very, very helpful. And sometimes a lot of us need something like that. We're not able to walk through that door over there and say, oh boy, I'm home. You know, that's just not a lot of our experience. So preliminary treatment is great. Unfortunately, in 1993, something like 800 treatment facilities closed in America because insurance companies got tired of paying for treatment like somebody's 18th treatment. You know, oh, you're coming back into a 30-day program for the 18th time? Can I ask you a question? What makes you think the 18th time is going to work better than the 17th time? So they get tired of this stuff, and they've been able to lobby for to be able to not cover long-term rehab. I think that insurances. I think the only thing an insurance company has to do is if you're in acute stages of withdrawal or something. I think that they need to cover a hospital stay of up to a day and a half. You know, and everybody in here knows a day and a half of treatment is like what? I mean, they release you and you're still drunk. So again, we're losing, we've lost a lot of our abilities to get into rehabs unless we're Donald Trump or we've got, you know, Blue Cross triple, you know, five star or something. So, so again, you may, you more and more, we're going to be called on to do it the way they did it in the old days, and unfortunately, that means getting somebody detoxed and getting them to a place where you can start to work with them. Now, some of us are not situated so that we can do that very easily. My wife and I, up until recently, have been able to be situated so that we could do that. And there's been quite a few people that we've taken right out of detox into our home for a period of time, never exceeding three weeks, by the way, and start working the steps, make sure that they're consistent in meetings, and if they're not too damn self-centered, try to get them some type of service commitment, whatever that may be. In other words, try to get them on the right path as far as recovery is concerned, not fellowship attendance, but recovery. And we've done that, and we've been probably successful more times than not. Another thing that I can talk about in wet drunk work, because I have a little bit of experience with it, is intervention. You're not going to find a lot about intervention in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's a valid endeavor. We've done four interventions at our house, very, very impromptu. And two of those people remain sober from thereafter. Now, these were individuals that were not really anxious to come into AA. These were individuals that were referred to us from one area or another, and usually friends of the family. And basically, what you do in an intervention is you get enough of the family members together, enough of the people that make a difference in their life, and it's basically you sit the person down and each person voices their reasons for that person's that person to get sober. You know, this is why we think you're killing yourself. You don't find a lot of this information in the Alcoholics Anonymous literature, but every once in a while someone will ask for your help, and you know, a family member will ask for your help. And I've just been guided to do this occasionally, if the situation warrants it. I've been guided to do this. And again, like I say, two out of four. So that's not too bad of an average. In the book, you're going to see on page 94, down here at the bottom, you'll see the first visit. On a 12-step call, if the person is not too drunk or not too sick from withdrawal, you can use this as a guide. You use this as a guide in how to work with the person. It gives you suggestions for the first visit. Over on page 96, it basically transitions into the second visit. Some of the information here is if the person is not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him. If he's sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval. In other words, there's a lot of suggestions about how to handle an individual when you're on a wet drunk call. I've found that by following the suggestions in working with others, what you do is you avoid wasting a lot of time. There, especially in my early days, there were people who were more interested in dragging you into their drama than they really were interested in trying to find a better way of life. How many times have you tried working with somebody who really just wants to update you on the newest tragedy in their life, you know? Oh, you won't believe what they're doing to me now. Oh. And you suggest something like, wow, you know, I think I would inventory that. Gotta go, click, you know. So there are a lot of people who are in, you know, they want to be a part of or they want to be involved in, but they're not sincerely interested in practicing a program of recovery. And there's usually two reasons for that. One of them is they haven't been adequately presented with the message. And the other is they've been adequately presented with the message and they don't care. They're going to keep doing what they want to do. So I think that what we need to be responsible for in AA is adequately presenting the message, adequately transmitting the information that someone needs to be able to make a decision to engage in the process of alcohol that you find in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone on a lot of 12-step calls, and when it talks about in here, tell them about the first step. Tell them about the second step. Tell them about how you made a decision. Tell them about how you inventoried some of your character defects. They're specific. Tell them about some of your drinking history. Exchange stories if that seems to be the right thing to do. Try to put yourself in the person's place and try to establish an identification with the individual so that they identify with you as at least a problem drinker, if not an alcoholic at that period of time. And that's important to do. You can botch a 12-step call. One of the lip-flapping bits of information that used to go around all the time, I don't hear it much anymore, but that's untrue. There's a lot of things in AA that are just not true that are said all the time. This is one of them. If the person's ready, there's nothing you can say wrong. If he's not ready, there's nothing you can say right. I don't believe that's true. I bet you there's tons of people that die because there's just the 12-step call is botched. It's someone that doesn't have an awakened spirit, or it's somebody that doesn't understand the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, or it's somebody that's talking about the wrong things on the 12-step call. You know, they're talking about the wrong things. Oh, man, if you come into AA, there's all these sober dances, and, you know, and we hang out. And, I mean, oh, okay, you know, I'll get sober so I can go dancing, you know. That's not going to work for me. I'll talk to you later. You can really screw up a 12-step call. Let's see what else I have written down here. On a wet drunk call, handy pieces of information. It's a good idea to have some things in the car with you. One of them is another person, okay? They always went on 12-step calls in the early days with somebody, and there's good reason for that. Another thing is have some things in the car with you. One of the things is alcohol. You know, if you just don't want to keep it in your house, buy some before you get over there, and then throw it away at the end of the 12-step call. Do something like that because they may need it. I'd say 25% of the 12-step calls that I go on, it would be a good idea to keep the person drinking so they don't go into withdrawal. Another thing is garbage bags. You know, a nice hefty garbage bag. Because if you've ever seen detoxing alcoholics, they tend to vomit quite often. And if you have that rich Corinthian leather in the back of your car, you may wish them not to vomit on it and to vomit into the garbage bag. This is something that you may not be able to pull off to the side of the road quick enough. So we recommend a hefty. You know, bring that along. I could go on and on and on. Make sure the person has his wallet, his or her wallet, information, insurance information, phone numbers, purse, whatever. Make sure that is available, because if you're taking them to treatment because they're a tad befogged, they're going to want to know who the hell they are. You know, you can't say, oh, this is Harry P. You know what I mean? They're going to want to know a little bit more information than that. Have a cell phone. A cell phone is good because you can call the people and tell them you're coming. You can find out what they require. The phone might be shut off at the 12-step. Who knows? Have a cell phone if you have one. Again, have a big book. I could go on and on and on. There's just use some common sense. If you get to a 12-step call where the person is really drunk and really violent, what I recommend is to not stay there unless the family is like freaking out. Call them in the morning. A lot of times, especially if you get calls from Night Watch and stuff like that, a lot of times drunks just want to talk with you. Oh, yeah, I need help. Yeah, you know, you should hear a little bit about my life. Let me talk to you for about 3 hours about my life. And then they'll wake up in the morning and they'll go like, I called who? You know? So make a call, you know, find out who they are, get their phone number, make a call the next morning and see if they want to see you. Another handy tip. If they feel that the 12-step call is a good time for them to start playing with their new handgun, you know, just get out of there, all right? You know, we do this to improve our spiritual condition and to help others, not to be target practice. You know, use some common sense. Again, I can't even talk about all my experiences, but I have been threatened on a number of two occasions actually by people, and you know, it's good to have somebody there, and it's also good to be able to get out of there if you need to get out of there. Try not to get involved in the family arguments. The first thing that's going to happen is the husband or wife is going to want to ask you questions like, should I divorce him? You know, should I throw the bum out? You may not want to get involved in those things. There's a statement in the book that says, see the man alone if possible. And what I believe that means is isolate the individual during the 12-step call from the rest of the family. If you don't do that, they'll tell him about what you did the other night, you asshole, you know, and hit him on the head with a rolling pin or something in the middle of the 12-step call. It's inconvenient. So try to isolate the individual from the rest of the family. If need be, get him out of the house. Again, on page 102, it says, your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. There's the text of the big book, and then there's the spirit of the big book. And if you read the book and you get the experience from taking the instructions, you'll get to a point where you'll understand the spirit of the book. And I believe one of the main parts of the spirit of the book is to turn you as an individual from somebody that just thinks about yourself and your little environment, you're self-seeking, you're selfish, and you're self-centered, and to turn you into the type of individual where it's more helping other people is the most important thing in your life. It's more important than anything else. You know, when the call comes, nothing else is more important that I may be able to save somebody's life. You know, it's not like, oh, well, you know, I'd come out on that 12-step call, but I scrape my feet every Thursday night, you know? I mean, you need to be at a point where you will respond to these calls. And that's the spirit of the text. And if you experience enough of this process, you'll inevitably get to that point where it's almost second nature to do that and to be available and to be generous with their time. I'm not saying that we have to handle absolutely every single emergency ourselves. I don't believe that. But I believe that we need to be of service. If we can't do it for one reason or another, we need to at least try to find somebody that will. At least, at the very least, point the individual in a direction that we have at least confidence in that there'll be help on the other side. I've just heard just horrendous stories about people, you know, who it's the Sopranos are on. I just, you know, I would come and help you, but I don't want to miss this episode. I mean, there has to be a decent reason, I believe. There's a couple other stories I'd like to go over. This is a good one. My wife and I get a call from the sister of this individual. This is somebody that I had been sponsoring and working with. Now, get this. You want to talk about some bad luck. This individual recognized he had a problem with alcohol. He made arrangements at Carrier Clinic to sign up and go in there for a 28-day program. He was to show up around 6 o'clock at night. So what did he do first thing in the morning? What do you do when you're going in? Yeah, right. You have a last go. And he started drinking vodka. And he did some laundry. You know, he tied some things up. He's on his way into Carrier Clinic with a glass of vodka between his legs. And coming out of Carrier Clinic, is a brand new nurse, brand new employee of Carrier Clinic. First day on the job, and she's coming out this way, and he's going this way. He head-ons. He goes across the double yellow and head-ons her and kills her. All right? This is a very, very sensitive individual. This is someone who never hurt anybody, in any vindictive way in his life. He's just an alcoholic and a very, very sensitive individual. And this, obviously, as it would any of us, really weighed on him and it made it very, very difficult for him to be clear of mind to try to recover. Well, he got to a point where the rehab he was in was telling him, you know, your stay is coming to an end. And he bolted out of there, and he ended up holing up in the Chelsea House in New York City. I don't know the Chelsea Hotel. Anybody know about the Chelsea Hotel? Well, that's where Sid Vicious chopped up Nancy and shoved her in the underneath the sink cabinet or whatever. I mean, it's a place where rock and rollers go to check out. It is like a romantic suicidal atmosphere about this place, and. So he's there. He's going to go there. We don't just go kill ourselves. We go to the Chelsea Hotel. And so he's in the Chelsea Hotel. So Mary Beth and T and I jump in the car, and we're going to go in and have a talk with him. We're going to try to talk him into coming back to treatment. We get in there, and we can't get past the lobby guy. We can't get up in there because he's not answering his phone. And the guy's saying, well, we have a policy of not disturbing our guests. I'm like, buddy, he's up there killing himself, you know. At the very least, we'll help you avoid some paperwork, you know. Let us up there. Finally, it was about an hour or so of convincing. Finally, we were able to go up there, and T and I went up there, and we had a talk with the guy. And probably within about 15 or 20 minutes, he was packing his bags, and he was off to rehab, and back to rehab. Again, I'm talking about a lot of take him to rehab stories. I don't want anybody to be confused about what the ultimate aim and goal of a 12-step call is. It's to get somebody through the steps so that they also can recover from alcoholism. But again, there's a lot of processes that you need to go through to do that. Probably one of the greatest feelings I'll have in my life is after working with somebody, after getting somebody to treatment, after getting somebody through the steps, after placing somebody in a position where you start to see their life change and you start to see someone whose soul has been asleep start to awaken. It's probably one of the greatest joys and greatest gifts that you can receive in life today. I have been privileged over the course of the last 10 or 12 years or so of being able to act as a channel for some of the healing spirit to get through to some people. And my first sponsor told me, he goes, Chris, if you help save one person from the alcoholic pit, your life won't have been wasted. Your life will have meant something. And I believe that that's true. I believe that that's true. And I believe that this group specifically talks a lot about the solution. It talks about how best to be of service to other people, how best to recover from alcoholism. What are some of the processes? What are some other people's experience who've been through this? And I think that when we first put this group together, it's going to be 5 years in December. By the way, the ultimate aim and goal of this meeting was to get people in here and to have them go through the 90-day or the 120-day sessions and get to a point where they've had the program of recovery adequately presented to them. Now they go out, they get an experience with it, and they carry the message somewhere else. And that really was the ultimate aim and goal of this meeting. And I think over the years it's fulfilled that aim. I think that there are a lot of people who've benefited from this meeting, and I think that there are a lot of people who have gone through this meeting who are now actively out there in the AA community and in the community at large, available and active as far as carrying the message and being of help to other alcoholics. And for that, I'm very grateful for the small part I've had in it. That's it for tonight. I want to tell everybody that next week we have the distinct honor and privilege of having Mike and Kathy L. Who are going to be doing a couple months, 2-3 months worth of presentation. It's going to be experiential rather than too mechanical, and I'm looking forward to that because they have a hell of a lot of experience to share. Please spread the message. They're starting right at the beginning with their stories next week, and please come out and get the benefit of some of their experience, strength, and hope. Okay, that's it. Thanks.